Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
The stuff you wear is inappropriate for what you're planning on doing.
You don't know anything about me. I'm ready.
You're not. So none of the stuff that you're thinking means anything anyway.
Never kissed anyone before.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
If you're just joining us for the first time on this podcast, what we do each week is Richard and I break down the latest episode of a show that we are currently fascinated with. Right now we are covering HBO's We Are Who We Are. We are on episode 6, if my math serves me correctly. So we will only be discussing up through episode 6. This week, we have not watched future episodes, so it's just all we know. We are who we are, and who we are people who only have seen through episode 6.
Chi siamo, chi siamo.
Oh, nice. Very molto bene.
Yeah.
If you want to, in your own way, be part of this podcast, here's the best way you can do it. You can email us. stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. We've been getting incredible emails around this show. I've been really, really enjoying everything you all are sending in. So we're going to start by reading a couple of those emails, talking about them before we get into this latest episode. I was telling Richard before we started recording that I just finished watching the episode and I have a little bit of like trauma, panic attack from the 2016 election night coverage that runs over the closing credits. And for both of us, since like I was over at my sister's and my sister doesn't have a TV, so I actually like found out about the election results on Twitter.
Oh, God.
And I was like watching through her window into her neighbor's window because they had a TV on. Kind of. It was a weird night. But
sounds poetical.
But neither of us watched the election night coverage. So Richard, sensibly, in an act of self-care, peaced out when he saw what was going to play over the closing credits of this episode. I watched all of it and did not have a good time. So this is We Are Who We Are, and Who We Are is Richard and Joanna watching a show set on one of the worst nights, in my view, in America's history. So okay.
Pretty bad night. Yeah.
Pretty bad night. And I mean, it'll be interesting to analyze why we think this is how this episode ended.
I have some thoughts about it. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. All right. All right. So this first email comes from Beatrice from Brazil. And Beatrice writes in and says, in We Are Who We Are, not only every word means something, but every silence means something. Your intelligent insights are a perfect fit to the show. Thank you. What a kind thing to say. Okay. She writes, what currently interests me most about We Are Who We Are is Frasier's connection to Harper, which was explored a lot already, Sarah and Jonathan. So Frasier's connection to Harper, Sarah, and Jonathan. Sarah is such a narcissist. She is the kind of character we love to hate. Have you noticed how Frasier is such a smart, eloquent, mature person around Harper and the rest of the people compared to when he's with Sarah, very childish, aggressive, and dependent? I feel like Jonathan will be a key part of the story, although the age gap concerns some of the audience. Elio and Oliver all over again. I'm not concerned about it. And here's, unfortunately, where Beatrice... Beatrice says, I assume they will have a platonic relationship and Jonathan will bring a lot to the table. Such an interesting, puzzling character. yet so simple and almost naive. So that's from Beatrice. So we can discuss whether or not we think this episode definitively puts that relationship in a non-platonic category. It's as with anything in the show, it kind of defies definition. Do you have any like immediate thoughts on that, Richard?
I guess it was interesting. I mean, as this show has done several times, it was interesting this week to be like, to have them finally tell you what was going on, you know, because we were like, maybe he's 19.
30.
And then there's like, and I think that she's maybe like rounding up a little bit because of the 27 Club thing. But like, yeah. Even so, regardless, like that's old, you know. So I think it just like, I think that was probably intentional on the writer's part to be like, to kind of tease us down this little path warily.
Yeah.
And then in this episode be like, oh, by the way, like this is potentially very bad, you know?
Yeah.
Even though he's a nice, seemingly nice guy, you know, like, you know, it's just a very interesting sort of whammy there that I think is also reflected by the closing credits.
Yeah. When Maggie said 30, I wrote in my notes, 30? Yeah. Like in all caps.
The whole time. Right.
The whole time. Yeah, exactly. All right. So this on the question of Jonathan and Fraser, here's an email from Ethan who writes in, "Hello, longtime listener, first time writer. I just want to thank you both for covering We Are Who We Are. It is definitely a different type of show from what you usually cover. But as a huge Luca fan, I'm enjoying the deep dive into each episode, even though I wonder if it is a show that will ultimately be best discussed and analyzed as a whole and not week by week. You have discussed the mostly bad faith arguments from some about the age difference between Elio and Oliver in Call Me By Your Name. It creates a scenario where I feel that frank conversations become impossible to have. I don't think it's revelatory to say that American audiences tend to be more prudish about conversations about and demonstrations of sexuality, and it does feel like Luca is bringing his particularly not American sensibilities to We Are Who We Are. I'm in total agreement with Richard's point about young queer people often seeking the mentorship of older people who are similar when there is a drought of contemporaries who understand. I believe the same can be said, though, for older people who may see a younger person and wish to imbue knowledge, life lessons, and friendship that they were perhaps deprived of. Jonathan sharing books with Fraser and being the one to invite him to sit together at the movies and showing an interest in what Fraser wants to do with his life all fits with that just as much as Sarah seeing something in Caitlin / Harper and taking them under her wing as she does. The mentorship isn't what makes us nervous, though, but the touching. In Jonathan and Fraser's walk and talk, Fraser is constantly brushing the arm of his jacket against Jonathan's, and I couldn't help but wonder why Jonathan didn't recoil. I can't help but wonder if a queer American director would have had Jonathan be more forward about barriers or have shot these scenes differently, which then makes me wonder if the problem is actually with me as a viewer for presuming the worst. Have the arguments of others shaded my views that much? If everything above doesn't make it obvious, let me say explicitly that it is hard to even articulate all of this, which is why I'm so grateful for you both for doing this podcast, because for all the theorizing and fun of Westworld, this is a show that does deserve the conversations we are having. It'll be interesting in the coming weeks to see how the Jonathan and Fraser relationship develops. In a show that does feel like a spiritual companion to Call Me By Your Name, it wasn't lost on me that Jonathan and Fraser bound themselves by a war memorial, just as Elio and Oliver did. However, there was no confession or admission here, just some playful air guitar. But there's little doubt in my mind that that in the coming episodes, their relationship will become more complicated. And then Ethan said some more nice stuff to us about our podcast. Thank you, Ethan. I don't know if we want to reopen that age gap conversation. I just think it is interesting. We talked about that aspect of mentorship of like an older person educating younger, but something that I do love in this episode that we watched this week is, you know, Fraser getting a book for Jonathan.
There's exchange, yeah, you know, yeah, I think the thing about the word mentorship, and I think that that's definitely a component of it, but that also implies a kind of tutelage. There's an imparting of knowledge, and that is, right, yes, a part of it, but there's also just a communion, you know, there's a there's a bonding, there's you know, an exchange, and I think that can be, that can take many forms, some less healthy than others, but you know, I think that there's a, the you know, despite matters of age, like the same recognizing same,
yeah,
especially in this environment, I think would be vital. And I mean, I got this episode kind of leaves some question as to like who Jonathan is, but like, you know, what he gets out of this, I think, is an interesting thing to think about. Thus far, it's less interesting if it goes into, I think, more sordid territory, because then it's more obvious, I guess.
Yeah, and like the show has been so good thus far, of just wriggling out from whatever expectations we might have. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that goes to one of the bigger points I want to talk about in this episode, and I actually just might take a detour to talk about it now, which is something I was thinking about at the start of the episode, like watching Harper in gym class and then talking with Fraser afterwards, stuff like that. I was like, what do these kids have in common besides their, like, you know, interest in sexuality and gender and expressions thereof, and then like Richard sort of expressed, the Richard in the show expressed something similar, like, you two have nothing in common. And I was like, but that is plenty to have in common, you know what I mean? That like same recognize same as you express. They're not exactly the same, but they are, they do have these questions beyond, you know, when Brittany shows up in this episode and says to Harper, like, we're still friends, not even are we still friends, but we are still friends. And then you look at that and you're like, but what do they have between them? You know, yeah, what I mean? So Fraser and Harper do have this profound bond over these questions that they're sussing out for themselves.
Yeah, I think that's the foundation of the bond in some ways. I think it's that they're two outsiders in a very ordered environment, you know, and that can, and sometimes when you're that age, like, that's all it takes, like you come together because, you know, your mutual ports in a storm, you know, and then through that, because they're so young, they develop interests together, you know, and I think that you see that reflected in the dance sequence in this episode. And the hair cutting from last week is that when they're giddy together, they're just in their own little private world, obsessing over the things or people they like, and in the way that kids do, you know. And I think that what something that I was thinking about with this episode, that a little moment where Fraser's watching the Karl Lagerfeld video,
yeah,
is, and I think the episode is sort of ambivalent about this. On the one hand, Fraser and Harper, two kids there, you know, each other's age, like, have that, but also Fraser especially seems to be like gazing at the grown-up world far away from him and kind of emulating that. And, you know, I've done a lot of like reporting and stuff on like YouTube culture and
yeah,
and like digital fame, and one of the sort of more cultural, broader academic concerns, or not concerns but like questions about all of that, is in this with generations now that are so steeped in like kind of lateral exchange between each other. You sign online and you see the latest YouTube video from a kid your age, or maybe a year or two older, or 3 years older. Whereas when we were young, minus the odd teen show that were all created by adults,
yeah,
we were watching stories and things made by grownups, music made by grownups for the most case, and sort of, right, looking up at that. And I think that, yeah, we developed aspiration towards things while also having our own friends or our peers. And I think that given that Harper and Fraser are in this community that is so led by adult interest and adult demand and requirement, that they are two people who are curious about life past this, but in a different way than the people getting funneled into the military industrial complex, that distinguishes them, you know. And whether or not it's a good thing that Fraser has heroes older than him, be it Karl Lagerfeld or Jonathan, or that Harper is watching young people on YouTube go through their transition. I think what this episode shows that both are valid forms of kind of para-communication with the outside world, I guess.
I love that. I hadn't thought about that idea of lateral communication, lateral education amongst this generation. But it's obviously what we're seeing, as you say, first on YouTube, now on TikTok, stuff like that, and or now on both. But it's fascinating. It makes me, of course, wonder, like, which I do all the time, what would my teen years have been like if I had grown up in a world where I could see that there were more kids out there like me than I thought, etc. You know?
Yeah. And I think that a lot of times that, and I'm guilty of it too, when I've written about YouTube and like how great YouTube is for, like, sure, it has neo-Nazis and racists and all that shit, but like it also has like queer coming out videos and things like that. And that is good, but that is not a replacement for real interaction. And I think that kids now still feel that and know that. That is abundantly clear in like mental health statistics and all that stuff. YouTube and Instagram have not saved people entirely. And I think you still see Fraser reaching out to this person in a way that that Harper doesn't have, you know, and that's why we get this, I think, horribly kind of sinister scene with Sarah toward the end of the episode.
I am really excited to talk to you about that. Let me circle back to, you brought up the dance sequence, and that takes me to another email we got from listener BB, who writes in, okay, first of all, I love your podcast, but I finally had to email you about some background on the show and the music. You mentioned the music in show previously, but somehow did not mention Dev Hayes. Dev Hines. She later emailed to say that she had misspelled the name. Okay, Dev Hines. Then in the most recent episode, Richard addresses the band that Fraser is obsessed with, and I have some information to pass along to you. Blood Orange, or Dev Hines, the musician that Fraser is obsessed with, is pretty fourth wall in the show. The score for We Are Who We Are is actually done by Dev, so it's been pretty hilarious that Fraser is so into him and has been playing his music pretty constantly whenever he puts his earbuds in. And so that, like, dance sequence that they do in this episode is to one of the Blood Orange songs, Champagne Coast, I believe is the title. Check out this crazy article. There's a New York Times article that BB linked to. Apparently, Dev was supposed to be in the show, but instead ended up doing the score. Also, Dev, though I'm not sure about his own sexuality, has been very supportive of LGBTQ. Fraser mentions as much when he is obsessing over him and talking to Harper about him. So it actually is a great fit that Dev is doing the show, the score for the show. Also, his music is fantastic, one of my favorites of all time. Just figured y'all might want to know. It's the first time I've had something to write to you guys about, besides telling you both how freaking awesome you both are. Thank you. I have been listening for a long time through many show recaps and across other podcasts of yours both as well. Basically, I end up loving anything you both watch. Really enjoy your opinions on all shows, so I'll be sticking around. Thanks, BB. And then BB went on to say, she wrote like two follow-up emails. She goes, actually, I had one bit of gossipy info to share with you as well to come full circle. Dev Hines was also pictured with / rumored to be dating Tessa Thompson. Not sure if they are still together or not right now, but now I've tied it into Westworld. So there you go. Tessa, like, I need to look this up really quickly to see if this is the person that she collaborated with on for Creed. I gotta check that out. But, you know, there was like a musician she worked with for her like music that she did for Creed. Do you know what I'm talking about? Does not seem to be this person. Okay, never mind. Okay, so so musically, that's interesting to me. I did not know that. Thank you so much, BB. That the music is so cohesively of an artistic point of view on this show. That makes sense to me for sort of what they're going for here. But I was wondering if you had any further thoughts on that, Richard.
Yeah, I mean, I found myself wondering, and it wasn't so much a music cue, but I think this all relates to each other. You know, in a previous episode, we see like a Klaus Nomi poster, and it's like, would a 15-year-old in 2016 have that? Maybe. And in this episode, he puts on the beret that is Timmy's beret from the end of Elio's beret from the end of Call Him By Your Name. And it's like, okay, did Luca Guadagnino like wear a beret when he was a teenager? You know, and I think that like that's okay if we have this director, this auteur guy, like, grafting some of himself onto these, like, more present tense kids. Because what he, if the specifics feel maybe biased toward Guadagnino's own experience, the more universal thing, it would be that the music or whatever is like how they feel about it and what it says about their like nascent sense of identity and things like that. And I don't know if that's at all an answer to that email, but, or that, or your question, but like, I don't know. I think that like, I appreciate the specific choices for what they say about Guadagnino. But I guess maybe sometimes I'm trying not to read into what those choices might say about the kid characters, because I don't know how much they're their own, I guess.
Yeah, that's like when the worst example of this, I think, is like something like Dawson's Creek, talking about like teen shows written by adults or stuff like that. But there's like so often, or more recently, the Halloween episode of Euphoria, like all the kids were dressed from like as like cultural references that really have nothing to do with their current generation. And it, you know, you often see like the obsessions of the adult writers or showrunners grafted on to these teen characters, which is sometimes, I mean, you know, not necessarily in this case with Blood Orange, but like that is always like a hilarious thing to observe in a show.
Yeah. At the same time though, I mean, like kids certain types of kids are constantly mining the past for material.
That's true.
You know,
that's true.
Like like Fraser mentioning G.I. Jane, or, you know, TikTok kids obsessed with Clueless, or, you know.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. Like, there are some characters on Euphoria, like Rue, Zendaya's character, like, who I would be like, okay, sure. But then there were some of the other characters who seemed to have zero cultural literacy, where I was like, And Fraser, I can see Fraser making a G.I. Jane reference, because I definitely believe that's something he, like, watched with Sarah or something like that. You know what I mean?
For sure.
But, yeah. All right. So, let's loop. I have one more email, and it's going to lead us into discussing that scene between Sarah and Harper at the end of the episode. And this email is from Mickey, and it's titled Trans Perspective on Harper. Mickey writes, I really enjoy your podcast, and I was happy to see you covering We Are Who We Are since I decided to watch it as well. I found the show a little slow, and I'm mainly stuck with it because I'm trans, and I'm interested to see how the character of Harper would develop. I was really heartened by how, from the very beginning, you two chose to refer to Harper as Harper and use the pronouns they, them. I know in the last episode you heard from a listener who criticized that choice as coming from an American perspective of needing to apply labels and pin things down, but I disagree. I work in the queer community, and I know how important it is to trans people to have their identities affirmed, and how painful it is for them when relatives, employers, faith communities, etc. choose not to do that. Your choice early on was actually an example of best practices, in my opinion. It's common in the trans community to default to they when one isn't sure what pronouns another person goes by. It's also seen as respectful to use the name someone chooses for themselves, as Harper did, as opposed to their birth name. It's your choice, of course, but as a trans person and a fan of your podcast, I hope you continue the practice of referring to Harper as Harper and using they, them. Best wishes, Mickey, she/her. So, you know, I think I am going to revert to doing that. I think both emailers make good points, but what Mickey says sort of aligns with other experiences that I've had in the trans community. And I think with this episode in particular, and what we see here, I think that is sort of a reasonable best practice, at least for myself going forward. But
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
I did want to talk to you about this scene with Harper and Sarah, which you, with the pamphlet and the presumptions that you, I think, referred to as disgusting. I can't remember.
Sinister.
Sinister. All right. Yeah. So
from Sarah's POV, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tell me why you think that.
I think that Sarah asking how is hunting and then sort of almost trying to one up her inferior in the military with like, well, look how, you know, hip to things I am to the truth. It felt so self-serving. And I couldn't tell how Harper reacted. I think that they like, I think it was clearly a mixed reaction, you know, and also was being presented not only with an adult, but their dad's boss, who was doing something that I guess you're told is like, look, an adult is caring and like getting down on your level and trying to like see you and help you. And I think that that maybe is part of it. I don't think Sarah's like evil, but it just seemed so presumptuous. It seemed a bit railroading in a way that like an adult, and to do it in a public place, I don't know, that an adult would just be so casual with all those assumptions. Felt a bit like bulldozing and like not fair to Harper's like development and her and their experience, you know?
Yeah, I agree with you. And I also feel like it made me really uncomfortable. I was watching it for Harper's reaction specifically, and they did seem to have like a little smile on their face as they were reading the pamphlet. And yeah. So, you know, I was like, I was going to take my reaction to the scene was really going to depend on how it landed with Harper. Right. But as with anything, and this is not a defense of her, this is just a truth of her. Sarah just has zero boundaries. I know a lot of people like her. She's not just like an alpha and vain and self-serving and all of that. It's just like the boundary issue, as we see in the scene with Frasier in the shower. You know, that she feels, or the way that she was talking to Jonathan about Frasier, that she feels just incredibly entitled and like has more of an entitlement of that around her own son, but like feels incredibly entitled to be in everyone's business. And when anyone calls her out on it, she's just like, what? I'm helping, sort of thing. It's so familiar and toxic to me. That lack of respect for boundaries, and especially with something as sensitive as what Harper is dealing with here, which I think we've seen Frasier support Harper in a way that feels so much healthier than what his mom, the alleged adult in the room, winds up doing at the KFC in the like mini mall. Come on. So yeah, I felt similarly. I really did.
And I don't, you know, it's not that like an adult who recognizes something in a kid should just shut up and never address it. You know, I don't, it's not that. It's just kind of the tone, the way Sarah went about it, this sort of angle of attack she used. And I guess in a way, like maybe in some senses, and maybe I'm just gleaning this from like 70s performance, but like what that, I mean, you know, we have this other generational exchange between Jonathan and Frasier, like, but what this one meant for Sarah, which was like, I am a powerful woman in a very, very male field, in a very, you know, patriarchal world. And I see this kid who maybe through Sarah's narrow view is in some senses trying to adapt to that or transcend that or change that. I mean, she literally says, we have to change. I want to change this world, and we have to know ourselves before we do that. And there was a part of me that was like, she's kind of talking more to herself than Harper in that moment, and using Harper as this kind of like vessel through which to like affect change, I guess. And that felt, I don't want to say predatory exactly, but it felt opportunistic and in a variety of ways. And that's why, I mean, it's a brilliantly played scene by both actors. It's just I think this whole episode, if we want to like go into more like and where the Trumpy thing at the end comes up, is like there's so much darkness creeping up on the characters in this episode. So, like a sense of real menace, actually. And I don't know where that's gonna go. But something tells me that because the end credits were what they were, like, remember that? It fucking sucked. And it, you know, it shocked most people, shocked the world. No one saw that coming. And I just wonder if, like, maybe in a kind of obvious way, Guadagnino is, like, telegraphing something to us on the audience, being like, something is coming. Something bad is coming. And, like, all of this, like, youthful possibility is about to get, like, snuffed out or something. I hope that's not true, but maybe.
Well, you know, the reason that the television credits, well, a reason that the television is just playing over the credits is that Sarah runs out of the room because she gets a call. And I would assume, if this were any other show, I'd feel much more certain. I would assume that the, you know, mission that she sent her troops on did not go well. Right. And she says how many, so I would assume, fatalities. But this show is forever surprising me, so I don't know. But that hammer dropping, at the same time as the Trump hammer drops, I think confirms your interpretation of this creeping menace. I mean, the same thing is true of like, okay, so, when Jonathan and Fraser sit down for dinner and Fraser is speaking Italian to the waiter and says, Jonathan speaks to the waiter and says the house special for three.
Mm-hmm.
either if we speak Italian or we get the benefit of the subtitles, we're like, oh, no. And like mm-hmm. Fraser is completely unaware for the next few seconds or minute or whatever. And we this girl winds up being, you know, as is typical of the show, she's not like your usual, like in another show, she would be like super mean to Fraser and hanging all over Jonathan or something like that. She just seems like super, she's cool chick or whatever. But, you know, it is a menacing thing that we're, a dramatic irony thing that we're aware of that Fraser's not aware of, sort of thing. So,
yeah. And I don't know. Was it 100% clarified that that was a girlfriend? I mean, I guess it was.
No.
I mean, yeah. But like, well, I mean, it. I think that they left that just ambiguous enough. Not that I'm like rooting for Jonathan and Fraser. I'm not. But like, I don't know. I think that like the way that Jonathan's character was handled in this whole episode was so interesting. I think particularly like, you know, I guess there was the war monument in an earlier episode, but there's this one where he takes Fraser deliberately to this place where tens of thousands of young men were killed 100 years ago, and does it, I think, to sort of kind of almost meanly prove a point to Fraser about like the 27 Club joke and like what it means for young people to die at a, you know, and
oh, interesting, yeah.
But also, it kind of reminded you that like that Jonathan like signed up for this thing, that like this is, you know, this is in him. This kind of militaristic reverence for that kind of sacrifice, you know, he's from a country where all the young people have to be in the military for a period of time.
Right.
You know, and that is for been mired since its creation. But, you know, like he, you know, for all of the kind of looseness and curiosity about art in the world that Jonathan represents to Fraser, here's another window into like who Jonathan actually is and the choices he's made and the things he values. And then that, it, you know, if there is this girlfriend that he's actually, oh, maybe he's a lot squarer than Fraser thought or we thought, you know. So I don't know if we're really like, I think we're supposed to still really like Jonathan, but see his limits as like a sort of idol or object of whatever for this kid.
Well, I think just constantly the show is like, stop trying to define people. I think that's what the show is always trying to do. So we're like, okay, is Jonathan gay? Is he sexually interested in Fraser? Like, he smiles when he reads the inscription in like a way that seems like a bashful sort of flirty kind of thing. He invites Fraser to this thing. He doesn't like fully correct him when Fraser says it's a date and then changes to whatever, but he says whatever, but he doesn't say this is not a date, you know what I mean? And then like this girl shows up, so then you're like, oh no, he's straight and this is a big misunderstanding. But then that's not how the night ends, you know, like this is the journey that I went on. I was like, oh, yes, he's gay. Oh, no, he's straight. Oh, no, there's going to be a threesome. Nope, it wasn't a threesome. It was just, like, I definitely thought karaoke was like Backstreet Boys is going to lead directly into like some sort of like threesome thing was sort of what I was anticipating. And it is not what happened. But I was just sort of, but in that way, the show is just constantly like, don't get comfortable with your assumptions that you understand what's going on. And that is reflected in, I think, a character like Richard, who is asking Harper, like, are you dating Fraser? but isn't that kid gay? I thought that kid was gay. Is that kid gay?
He seems gay.
Yeah. He seems gay. He's gay. You know what I mean? And you're like, Richard, buddy. No. I mean, like, let's just not box anyone. And also Richard also defying some expectations because, you know, we expected Richard to, you know, lose it when he found out about Harper's hair, which he did. But then, you know, she makes, a plea essentially for empathy at the end of last week's episode, and he gives it to her, even though he's not fully informed about what's going on. Sorry, to them. He's not fully, aware of what's going on. But in this episode, even though Harper is grounded, you know, Richard's not being awful to them. He is trying in the best way that he understands, in the best and limited way that he understands, he is trying to connect with his child in this episode, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Which I think is, once again, not what I necessarily would have expected from a character like Richard.
Yeah. No, I think it is really interesting the way that whole hunting trip plays out, especially how eager Harper seems to be about aspects of it. Mm-hmm. But we've known that about them previous, you know, to this episode. But I think that, like, that this episode has these two men taking their charges off into the wilderness to, like, teach them something or mm-hmm. show them something is interesting. It's an interesting parallel. And on the one hand, you have this very, like, traditional, like, we're gonna camp, we're gonna hunt, we're gonna, you know, maybe we'll have a little gruff bonding, or I'll pry into my kid's life for a little bit, you know, while I have them captive, essentially. And on the other, you have this very nebulous, what the hell's going on sort of fluid thing, where in that scenario, in the Jonathan Fraser scenario, there is this kind of reverence for the past and an eagerness not to repeat it, and a sort of questioning of where we are in history and in this sort of flow of time. Whereas on the other, it's Richard kind of teaching ritual to his kid, this age-old stuff, that this is what we do, you know, regardless of the gender question at the center of their relationship, here's still just like tradition. So you have tradition, and then you have another side of things that is like reverent of tradition, but also is kind of allowing for the new. So you have Trump on one side and you have Hillary Clinton on the other, or the Republicans on one side and the Democrats. And I mean, Democrats, not like progressives, Democrats on the other. Like, I feel like that dichotomy was not, again, going back to the end of the episode, an accident.
It's interesting because, quick tangent. I watched all of season 4 of The Crown. This is related, I promise. We can't really talk about it yet. I think we're still under embargo on that. I know, Richard, you watched at least some of it. Mm-hmm. But it got me thinking about, again, my favorite royal, which is Princess Anne. And who I only have discovered is my favorite royal because of The Crown. So I watched, please don't judge me, I watched a documentary on Princess Anne because I was just interested.
You work at Vanity Fair. I feel like it's required.
And something that, you know, and actually one of the main talking heads on this documentary was our royal correspondent, which was pretty funny. But one of the phrases that they used over and over and over again in that documentary is that Princess Anne is the son Prince Philip never had. That, which is just, you know, a nasty little dig at Charles, but also just an exploration of the relationship that Philip and Anne have, which is between father and daughter, which is incredibly close. And they're both like, they enjoy the horses and the whatever, you know, they bond over the thing, and Charles is more artistically inclined, etc. And I was just thinking about that as it pertains to like Richard and Harper, who he thinks of as Caitlin, where like, because he has rejected Danny as a child, essentially, that Caitlin is the son, you know, Caitlin as he views her, Caitlin is the son he never had. And so it will be incredibly interesting. You know, that's just such an incredibly interesting dynamic for the show to have set up, that Richard is treating this child as if they were a son, but will that view of them help him through what is coming, or what may be coming, in terms of actual gender identity and expression.
Yeah.
Does that make any sense?
No, it does make sense. And I think that's kind of partly what made me detect this note of menace creeping. It's not just the Sarah scene. It's the way that Richard was looking at Fraser when the kids were leaving school. It's the questions that he asked about Fraser. It's the knowledge that, like, that we saw early in the season that, like, there is a tension, at least maybe it's unstated, but, like, a tension between Sarah and Richard and, you know, this political tension and all this stuff. Like, I'm just a little concerned that, like, that is going to come to some sort of a breaking point.
Completely.
In the next two episodes, you know, it could be violent. I mean, you know, if you want to follow certain rules, guns have been introduced, you know?
Yeah.
Clearly in two instances now, at least in one, it would probably be a violation from Richard's perspective that Sarah took Harper shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this episode, that is actually a violation. In some senses, you know,
mm-hmm.
it was really not Sarah's purview to have that conversation with Harper, even if there was an altruism and a genuine compulsion to do good. And I'm not trying to discourage adults, you know, to like...
I think there's a version of that conversation that could have happened that didn't feel quite so.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So like, should Richard find out about that? Like, that could be really bad. And so I don't know. I think that like, maybe the dangerous thing is just what Sarah got the phone call about, and that's going to be how the show kind of reminds us of, like, the violence of the world. But I don't know. I feel like it's going to be a little more local than that.
No, I mean, Richard definitely feels like a coiled spring, and, like, we saw that in his interaction with his wife. And I just want to be, like, cognizant of the ways in which this show constantly surprises me of my expectations of things. So, like... I just want to leave the door open for it to not go horribly, but it'll probably go horribly. It's just interesting because, like, I don't know. Like, I was expecting there to be some kind of explosion on the camping trip when it turns out that Harper's a really good marks person. And, like, if Harper had said, well, Sarah's been showing me, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, that could have gone incredibly badly, but Harper was smart enough to not say that. But yeah, I have questions. I have concerns. Both of these children feel like they're in a very potentially very vulnerable position, both Fraser and Harper.
And I think that, like,
yeah,
to varying degrees, I mean, Harper is obviously more keenly aware of the imminent sort of unsafety of her life, or excuse me, of their life. But I think Fraser isn't. And it's like clearly, but like there's something there. There's risk, you know. And I think it would be blinkered of a show, a fantasy of a show, to not depict any of that risk and not depict any of that danger. I just can't really tell because, like you said, like, the show is hard to predict. Like, I can't tell, like, how harsh the realization is going to be, you know?
Yeah.
I hope it's not, like, too extreme.
The last thing one other thing that I want to bring up that this episode deals with is Maggie. We mentioned Maggie earlier in terms of being a potential surrogate for some members of the audience worried about, you know, an older man and a young boy and stuff like that. But also what's going on with Maggie in this episode is that she's constantly on texting on her phone.
Yeah.
Stuff like that. If my interpretation of what we see is that Sarah knows what's going on and that this is like part of their relationship, and it's, if not okay, is something that is like allowed. Does that make sense to you as an interpretation?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that little scene up because I was going to ask you about it if you didn't.
Yeah.
I liked it, you know, like the smelling of things, like that's clearly like that was in Call Me By Your Name, and Fraser like smells the dinosaur and the other thing, and then Sarah's smelling the clothes, and it's kind of this like sweet moment of like, oh right, like it's her son and she loves him. And then she turns her head and then there's like a whole other family thing happening that she's maybe not been paying as much attention to. I don't know what that sort of look was. You know, it was clearly a realization of something.
Well, she said this thing earlier also where she was like, you've not been spending a lot of time in the house.
Right.
And it didn't seem to me to read as like, and I don't know why. Mm-hmm. It's like, I know why you haven't been around. And while this is technically allowed in our marriage, I don't love it. Or like, is this going to, you know, maybe I'm like way over interpreting something very small, but like, is this going to be a problem? Like, is this something bigger than our usual allowed extramarital flirtations or relationships, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, maybe they have an open relationship to some degree, you know? And yeah. I think the aesthetics of the way that their house, we see a lot of their house in this episode, and we see, you know, Sarah kind of like casually picking a book off the shelf because like, oh, my kid's gone. I have some free time. I'm going to go take a sexy bath with my wife and maybe I'll read a book. And the house is decorated in a certain way. And so, you know, maybe they have a certain more cosmopolitan progressive view of things. The real problem is, again, with the menace, is Maggie is with Richard's wife.
Yeah.
And so from a certain perspective, here comes this vampiric family that shows up on the base, seizes control, and then like just attaches itself to this other family, you know?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
And I, you know, I think that that would be almost like what's the castle defense, the stand your ground kind of thing. It would be like, no, I was invaded. We were invaded. This is defense, you know, mm-hmm. If the show goes that way.
Yeah. I do want to say for the record that we got some emails and I definitely got some tweets and comments from people being like, Joanna, you're so naive that you didn't see the Maggie and Jenny thing coming. So, you know, everyone disagreeing with you, Richard, that, I guess I think once again, this speaks to the show subverting my, I just don't ever think of the, like, I don't expect the quote unquote nice, passive partners to be the ones engaging in an affair. Mm. And I would expect a Richard or a Sarah who are more self-serving, more in need of validation, seemingly, to be the ones to conduct an affair, not necessarily with each other, but I just mean like outside their own marriage. And, you know, but as everyone, including yourself, pointed out, fingers in the pie should have told me where this was going. But, so, you know.
But I mean, part of that is that, like, you know, I studied theater in college and, like, you know, I think it was Aeschylus who established that dramatic precept that, like, if you see fingers go into any sort of baked good,
yeah,
a romance is going to come out of that. So that's just an old like theater major thing.
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah. Aeschylus is baked good. Yeah. Thing. anyway,
Oedipus and his mom do it.
It was a tart, if I recall correctly. Yeah. So it's interesting. The Maggie stuff is interesting to me. That also seems like potentially headed for disaster. They did. So let me ask you a question and I maybe need to rewatch some Guadagnino movies. What a chore. But the staring down the camera technique I associate very closely with Barry Jenkins. Is that something that Luca Guadagnino has used in his filmography that you can recall?
Are like, do you mean that particularly the music, the dance thing or?
No, sorry. I mean, staring down the camera, I mean, there's a shot, reverse shot of Maggie and Sarah, where the camera is close to them and they're looking direct. They're not looking
right. Yeah,
to
yeah.
the left yeah. or the right of the camera. They're looking directly at the camera. And that's something that like Barry Jenkins does it in, I think he has a name for it, but I can't remember what it is. But he does it often like silently. You'll just get like Kiki Lane or Andre Holland just like eye fucking you through the camera or whatever it is. You know, and there was this interesting moment where it's like Maggie and Sarah are looking at each other, but they're looking at us actually.
Yeah.
And I don't recall that being something he does often.
No, that's a good point. I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of interesting aesthetic stuff in this episode. That's interesting. I love the way that kind of dusky scene where Harper's looking for a cell connection and Richard is calling her name and that like marshy thing, that was beautiful.
Yeah.
And then the like the dance thing where like they're clearly just fancying themselves in a music video, that's why they're looking at camera in that scene. But yeah, I don't know, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
All right, well, is there anything else we want to talk about in this episode?
No, well,
the dance sequence is that was a fantasy, right?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Okay, I think it was just trying to express that, like, we're getting torn apart from each other right now because Harper has to go do this thing with their dad and whatever. But, like, inside, maybe even just the language of text messages, we're, like, having a little kiki, you know?
I did love Harper's text that was like, what if he's a psycho? And in the same breath, what if you fall in love? Like, those are two, you know, and this, you know, as you mentioned before, this close contrast between danger and death and war memorials and blah, blah, and life and love and passion and youthful excitement, and how close they are. It's interesting. I didn't remember that he uses a war memorial in Call Me By Your Name, but like that just drives home the idea that, I mean, it's in a bigger splash too. There's a murder and then there's, you know, there's a death and then there's like sex and passion and stuff like that. So, you know, it's the Romeo and Juliet thing, which we talked about, you know, in the party episode two episodes ago. Like it's just, these kids are drenched in like death and war and all this sort of stuff like that, but also life and love and passion exist there as well. And are they the same? Do they stand in contrast to each other? What we are, who we are. That's it. Mm-hmm. The end.
There you go.
All right. Richard, until next week, where can folks find you?
Well, on Twitter at Rylaws and writing at vf.com. But actually, it's kind of exciting this weekend. Well, I guess you'll hear this after the weekend, but the older guy I have a crush on is taking me to Gettysburg. I don't know, I guess to like,
what?
I don't know. There's like a field there, something happens. So that should be kind of fun. Yeah.
I hope you guys pee together on the field.
Oh, we didn't talk about that. Well, I think we all got what that was. But anyway, until next week when we can talk more about the peeing if you want. Where will you be, Joanna?
VF.com. You can hear us over on Little Gold Men, of course. You know, I think I will be performing my favorite karaoke song. Actually, it genuinely is. I want it that way as a karaoke banger. So I will be performing some Backstreet Boys at karaoke at a restaurant somewhere.
That's otherwise closed.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. We will see you all next week. Ciao.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ audio network like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.